It's time for Let's Talk Legal with your hosts, Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins from the law firm of Harvell and Collins. If you've got a legal question, they can give you the answer. Call now, 252-247-7282. And let's talk legal.
And Wes Collins joins us from Harvell and Collins this morning. Good morning, Wes.
Hey, Ben. How are you?
Welcome to the program. Good to have you here.
Good to be here.
So what are we talking about today?
You know, Ben, over the last couple of weeks, we've talked about just kind of some basic issues with regard to estate administration, the ins and outs of that, how to deal with an estate properly after someone's passing. We talked about what the executor's role is and what an executor is, and a different term there being an administrator. Went through all these type things. Today I'm going to talk about the different types of litigation related issues that you come up with or that you deal with relating to an estate.
Okay, and that's your role at Harvell and Collins, right?
Yeah, I do all of that. I have a couple of support attorneys, associate attorneys that work with me, but I'm the lead litigation attorney really in all areas, and it just happens to be that we do so much estate work that a lot of litigation seems to touch and concern estate-related matters.
Okay,
yeah,
all right.
So kind of big picture-wise, you know, when you have an estate going forward, of course, someone has passed away. We say the estate has been opened. You know, that means that you go to the clerk of court, you put the will on record if there is one. If there's not, then the estate could still be opened, but through intestacy, meaning it passes through the state statutory scheme, depending on the circumstances. An executor or administrator, personal representative, is appointed to do the things that they're required to do in order to administer the estate, such as take care of the debts, take care of claims, make sure the assets are gathered and safeguarded. Then eventually, after we pass through the statutory time frame or the time frame necessary to do the things that need to be done, which is almost in every case a matter of months, in most cases at least, sometimes longer than that, depending on the circumstances. And that's the process of the, you know, estate administration. Now, through that,
every step there can be challenged, right?
Every step can be challenged. I mean, obviously, if you're in a situation where you're the fiduciary, you're the personal representatives, and maybe the family is somewhat disjointed, maybe there's some brothers or sisters out there who don't necessarily see eye to eye with you as the executor, then they may kind of pick away at the things that you're doing. So that's, you know, that's part of it. I mean, just doing it right to make sure we don't have litigation related issues. That's important. But it's kind of, I think, the maybe four or five areas that we see, where we're talking about an estate that's involved in litigation would be, you know, the most notable one or most common one would be just a will caveat, which would be a challenge to the actual will itself.
Yeah, the validity of it, whether, you know, if somebody shows up and says, well, this is the one my mom gave me.
Right.
I don't know what the one you have is.
Right, exactly. So there's a particular set of statutes in North Carolina that deals with that and indicates what you do in order to file a caveat and how the court handles it and those type things. Before I get into that, let me kind of go through the four or five different areas. There would be the will caveat. There could be maybe a trust challenge, kind of the same thing there. Maybe the person doesn't have capacity to enter the trust, or that is the argument anyway, or they did it under undue influence. You can have issues such as a declaratory judgment action, which is like an interpretation of the will. What does this mean, this term in the will? This language in the will is not clear. You can either bring that directly before the clerk of court, or it can be brought directly in superior court, declaratory judgment action. In the event you have a situation where you've got the executor potentially doing some things poorly or not doing some things correctly, then you have a petition to revoke their letters. I'm going to come back on and talk about each one of these. And those are really, you know, the primary areas that you have. I mean, sometimes you have estates involved in litigation. Maybe, you know, a lot of times we have situations where maybe there's an ongoing lawsuit. Maybe it's a land-related suit, trespass suit, boundary line dispute, you know, something like that. And then one of the persons involved dies.
Mm-hmm.
Well, then the estate is then substituted in, so the estate could be involved in litigation.
Mm-hmm.
Just because of that, because
I would imagine in an intestate estate, you have maybe a challenge to who's the administrator.
Right. I wouldn't go so far as to say that's really litigation so much.
Mm-hmm.
In many cases, it's a race to the courthouse.
Right.
You know, the clerk of court is going to issue those letters of administration as per statute. I mean, we're going to look at the spouse first.
Mm-hmm.
You know, then we're going to look at the next of kin, and it could be that, you know, there's five next of kin, and, you know, so there could be a hearing as it relates to that. So the clerk has to make a decision as to who, you know, should be named in that particular spot. But, you know, that kind of brings up a good point as well. I mean, obviously, you don't want to set up your estate for that kind of potential dispute.
Right.
Just get a will done so that you indicated in your mm-hmm. in your document who you want your executor to be, and that's what the clerk is going to go by in almost every case. So kind of backing into this, the will caveat, you know, that's when we deal with a situation where the estate's been opened, the will's been put on record, and then someone who has standing, someone who would be affected by that will, then files a caveat to it, which is just a challenge. As we've talked about before on the program, from a broad perspective, that is normally based on an allegation that there's undue influence, meaning there was so much influence on this person who signed this will that it ended up being the intent of the influencer,
mm-hmm.
the product of the influencer, what the influencer wanted, and not what the actual principal, the person who signed
right.
the document, wanted.
Right.
Or lack of capacity,
mm-hmm.
which, you know, obviously lack of capacity is the person, an argument that the person didn't have the capacity to sign the document at the time that they signed it.
Mm-hmm.
And really, that's a relatively low standard in North Carolina. Basically, you just have to know, you know, who your family is, what you have, and what the effect of the document is, and what mm-hmm. your intent was. So it's not... you know, it's kind of a different standard when you're talking about, you know, even someone who's adjudicated incompetent, for example.
Right.
That doesn't mean they don't have the capacity to sign a will, because they're two different standards. That's a good way to describe it. Normally, you don't want someone who's adjudicated incompetent
exactly.
signing a will, but
yeah.
when push comes to shove, it's not a definite situation where that will would not be valid. So in the event that a caveat is filed, then the clerk is required to enter an order freezing the estate.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously the reason why is because we don't want assets to be dispersed out
yes.
when we're not exactly sure how eventually they're going to go, because we don't know if this will that's mm-hmm. been put on record is going to be the last will, or whether maybe another will or no will if there wasn't a will before.
So you just stop everything.
So you stop with regard to disbursements. But, you know, sometimes when you're dealing with the administration of an estate, you can't stop everything.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there are taxes that need to be paid. There are bills that need to be paid. There are things that need to be done.
Mortgages. Yeah.
That's right. So typically what happens is that while there be an order freezing the estate, either the attorneys involved in that agree, yes, these disbursements can be made because these are just like administration-type expenses that need to get paid.
Mm-hmm.
And in the event the attorneys who are involved in the caveat can't come to an agreement with regard to that, then you file a motion with the clerk, and the clerk says, yes, you can pay this. No, you can't pay that. You know, those type things. So that caveat litigation sometimes takes a good amount of time to eventually get through the discovery and get to a trial. And every caveat case has to be resolved by a jury trial. You can't opt to not have a jury. That's an unusual situation in most.
That's interesting.
In most litigation type situations in North Carolina, you know, the parties can decide, well, we're going to go ahead and try this issue just by the judge, a bench trial without a
right.
jury, but not in a caveat. You have to have a jury trial.
Yeah.
That's by statute. And also in the event that a caveat settles, let's mm-hmm. say that you go to mediation or whatever and have a family settlement agreement that maybe is inconsistent with the way the last will is written, but it's something that makes everybody happy so that we're, or at least happy enough. So we're able to come to a resolution.
Yes, usually a compromise.
Yeah, a compromise of some sort on both sides so that we can be done with this and move on. Well, that has to get the stamp of approval by a Superior Court judge.
Mm-hmm.
Also, with regard to a caveat when you file it, well, it's filed with the clerk's office because that's where the estate is pending, mm-hmm. but it's automatically transferred to Superior Court. So it goes right up to the highest trial level court. So a Superior Court judge is overseeing, you know, the trial itself, any motions, you know, those type things.
Well, the clerk's office is technically the clerk of Superior Court, so I guess that's why.
That's right.
It's a connection.
That's right. But certain, you know, areas of litigation, like I was saying, the declaratory judgment action, interpreting what is meant in a will, for mm-hmm. example, that can be brought just before the clerk, and the clerk can be the
right.
judge on that.
Right.
But any party can kick it up to Superior Court if they feel like they want to. They can transfer it up there if they feel like that, you know, we want a actual Superior Court judge to hear it as opposed to, you know, a clerk.
Okay. All right. More to come in a moment. If you have questions, again, about how estate administrations are and those issues that come up, the problems that come up, how they're litigated, you can give us a call right now at 247-7282 for Let's Talk Legal with Harvell and Collins. We're talking litigation on estate administration with Wes Collins from Harvell and Collins. If you have a question, 247-7282. So where were we on that?
So just kind of going through the areas that mm-hmm. we normally see when you're talking about litigation in estates. We're talking about, you know, will caveat challenge.
And what court hears it?
Yeah, Superior Court, right. So we were talking about the will caveat, challenge to the will. I guess the next issue that we see would be in the event that we have a trust associated with the will, then in many times if you have a caveat, you're going to have a challenge to that trust as well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's not a specific statute on point like a caveat statute as it relates to a trust challenge. I mean, you've got this 36C statute that gives you some rights to challenge a trust, but it really is just a lawsuit
mm-hmm.
in Superior Court. That's a caveat's a little bit different.
Because really, if you're trying, if the trust is part of the will, you're really challenging the whole thing, right?
Well, I mean, in many cases, you might have a will that then pours over into a trust.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, then if the will's 50% of it and the trust is 50% of it, mm-hmm. so you really need to deal with both of them.
Mm-hmm.
And there's really no way to deal with the trust in a caveat because the caveat is for purposes of one thing and one thing alone. That is to determine whether the will is, in fact, the will.
So is it linear then? You have to deal with the whether or not the will is a will, and then you can deal with the trust? Or?
Well, what we normally do in dealing with this, in many cases, there's some agreement at least to consolidate the cases, at least maybe for discovery purposes.
Mm-hmm.
So you're not taking, you know, two sets of depositions and running up
right.
you know, unnecessary expense. So, you know, if you take the depositions of the folks who are involved in the will, then you probably are going to be involved in the folks who are, those are going to be the same people who dealt with the trust.
Right.
You know,
okay.
So you've got some overlap, you know, with regard to that. There's not a specific statute on point that requires for the trust administration to be frozen.
Mm-hmm.
However, upon a lawsuit or trust challenge to be, you know, when it's filed. So, you know, in many cases, the parties, you know, will come to an agreement that we're going to freeze everything and hold everything where it is as of the time of the filing.
Right. Okay.
So that's normally by agreement, or in the event the parties can't agree, you know, a motion before a Superior Court judge to freeze the administration. But you know, these caveat and trust challenges, they really need to be filed pretty early on too, because you know, you got these. You know, you got a situation where you freeze the administration of the estate so that we are sure to preserve assets and not disperse potentially inconsistent with the terms of the documents that we're
right.
dealing with. And normally, if you need to file those within 90 days of the date of the estate opening. Because
okay.
after that, you know, really the administrator, the executor is kind of free to go ahead and make some disbursements because we know what all the claims are
mm-hmm.
because of the 90-day period of time. So it's kind of a no-no to wait much longer than 90 days, you know, on that if
yeah.
you're the one filing it.
Yeah.
you know, be that as it may, you know, we still end up in most cases with a freeze of both the trust and the will, you know, really by consent as it relates to just the trust.
I would imagine one of the problems there is that you have, may have people that are estranged and they don't even know
right.
when events happened.
Yeah. Well, yeah, there's no doubt about that. But dealing with the caveat side of things and then a challenge to a trust, we see that quite often. Then, moving on, let's talk about if we have a situation where we feel as though the administrator, personal representative, executor of the estate, these are all synonymous terms, is not doing what they're supposed to do.
Right.
Well, then you have that right to file a petition to have their letters revoked.
Mm-hmm.
And that basically just gives, that puts them in a position where their right to serve as this executor of the estate is taken away from them.
Mm-hmm.
In the event that they've done anything wrong with regard to the administration, maybe benefited themselves, then they could bring personal liability upon themselves.
Mm-hmm.
But really the first step in dealing with that in many situations is going to be to file that petition that is before the clerk of court initially. The clerk, you know, considers the evidence at a hearing and makes a determination as to whether those letters, you know, would be revoked.
Mm-hmm.
Then, you know, as a necessary part of that would also be that who is going to serve in this person's position if they are revoked.
Right.
So, you know, that's something that we see, you know, fairly often when we're talking about litigation, you know, involving an estate. And then, as I mentioned before, sometimes you have interpretation issues. You have issues. Just had one recently where a particular piece of property was going to closing.
Mm-hmm.
It passed to the seller of the property through a will. And then the closing attorney was looking at the will and had their title company look at it as well. Title company raised an issue. Said, I don't know if this property really did pass to this person.
Ah,
it's a little
wow.
bit confusing here. It's not really, really clear. So we looked at it, and basically the name of the game with regard to that is you got to get the title company happy with it.
Yes, that's
because
right.
Because they're the ones giving title insurance.
Yeah.
So that held up the whole closing. So there was one party that we needed to contact to see if this party who would have been the beneficiary, depending on the interpretation of the will, contacted the party to see if this person would just sign a quit claim deed for her interest in the property so it would be over with and we
right.
wouldn't have to do anything else. Well, that went down like rusty nails. I think she saw a payday.
Uh-huh.
So she didn't get a payday though because we filed an action in before the clerk of court for the court to interpret the will, make a determination as to what was intended by this unusual language, poor language, I would say, in the will. And once we did that, the person who we wanted to sign the quitclaim deed pretty much folded immediately.
Mm-hmm.
She then did sign it. We got it. We filed it. We're proceeding with closing. But if she didn't do that, we'd have to go have a hearing before the clerk. And that's the kind of case that can get kicked up to Superior Court, too.
Yeah, but it could also have been prevented with better language, right?
Just a poorly drafted document.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we see that sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
We just, you know, we deal with the will as it's written when the person's passed away because, my goodness, you can't change it afterwards.
Yeah, that's right.
And you know, there are far-reaching effects. You know, when you're talking about, you know, folks' assets, real estate,
absolutely.
Money,
yeah.
you know, whatever it may be, passing under the terms of a particular document. And, you know, if there's some confusion with regard to that, many times you've got to get that court order that resolves that confusion so we can move on.
If you want to ask your question, you can call us now at 247-7282 with Wes Collins from Harvell and Collins talking about estate administration actions. And welcome back again to number 247-7282 if you'd like to ask a question.
Right. So we're talking about all types of litigation involving estates. You know, some other things that we get into would be potentially litigation involving maybe use of a power of attorney.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes we have an estate pending. We have a situation involving an estate that may involve some property that was affected by a power of attorney, and therefore we have some issues relative to how that property eventually passes, because there's an allegation that the power of attorney was misused.
So the power of attorney goes away at the death, but however, the ramifications of it do not.
Right.
Person still is responsible.
Right. You know, one of the areas that we see more frequently than I would hope would be, you know, use of a power of attorney to, you know, sign a deed, you know, convey mm-hmm. away property of someone who is maybe doesn't have capacity, doing that inconsistent with the person's wishes.
Yeah, self-dealing kind of way.
Right, and then we don't know about it until the person's died.
Mm-hmm.
In many cases, we don't. Sometimes we do know about it, because obviously if the deed's recorded, we can learn about it. But just because it's recorded in the courthouse doesn't mean we get a memo on our phone about it.
Mm-hmm.
We may not, you know, learn about it right away. Sometimes, you know, use of a power of attorney to affect an account, like to make an individual account a
right.
joint account.
Mm-hmm.
Man, we hear that one all the time, where, you know, a power of attorney is used to make an account that was in dad's name alone, you know, dad and daughter,
mm-hmm.
and the daughter is the power of attorney, and upon dad's death, that $300,000 account, for example, passes all to daughter.
Mm-hmm.
But the intent was to only have the authority to be able to write checks on that account. And, you know, maybe under dad's will, for example, that account was
right.
supposed to pass to all four kids. And we get into potentially issues with regard to whether the person changing that account using the power of attorney under this scenario would be the daughter, whether she had the authority in the document,
mm-hmm.
you know, whether she breached her fiduciary duty, acted outside the scope of what the principal wanted her to do, engaged in constructive fraud. You know, a lot of these things twist and turn around estate administration, because
right.
you learn about these things, you know, upon or after the death. You learn about these accounts. You learn
yeah.
about how they've been dealt with. Other things that we deal with as far as estate litigation, elective share claims are kind of a big ticket item sometimes. We've
mm-hmm.
talked about that on the program. I know we just have a minute or so left. But sometimes that could be some pretty significant litigation before the clerk. The elective share statute's real clear about how you calculate that elective share claim of the surviving spouse.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes there's some twists and turns based on the assets.
Yeah, you got to have an inventory, good inventory.
It gets to be very complicated in how we calculate that.
And you have a clock running on that too, don't you?
Yes. 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
You have to file that elective share claim within 6 months of the date of the letters being issued, meaning the estate
mm-hmm.
being opened. And that's a huge issue there. I mean, folks, surviving spouses, especially in second marriages, you know, don't forget you have that right to file an elective share claim. Get legal counsel to help you with that
mm-hmm.
so that you can recover what the law allows you to get, as the surviving spouse. In North Carolina, you can disinherit everybody
mm-hmm.
except for your surviving spouse, unless there's a prenup, unless there's
right.
some type of agreement that
yeah.
you waive your rights.
Yeah. But finding out the assets that may have been hidden away, that's going to be sometimes this is a tough part.
Yeah. But that elective share statute indicates that you've got to be pretty much forthcoming about it. And if you're not, you might end up paying the other side's attorney's fees.
We'll have more next week on Let's Talk Legal with Harvell and Collins. And as always, you can go online at harvellandcollins.com.